But the rivers in Virginia could also be a weakness for the Confederacy if the United States decided to use them as waterborne avenues of advance against the Confederacy to turn Confederate units who are positioned north of any of the rivers. For example, after the Battle of First Manassas, when the main Confederate force was north of the Rappahannock and south of the Potomac, a Union advance to the Rappahannock River would have gotten in the rear of those Confederate forces and forced a retreat. George B. McClellan used the rivers brilliantly. In the spring and early summer of 1862, he moved his massive Army of the Potomac down the Potomac River to the mouth of the York and the James Rivers and used the York and James as axes of advance against Richmond from the southeast, a very efficient use of the Virginia rivers against the Confederate defenders. So in Virginia, the rivers can go either way, perhaps a plus, perhaps a minus for the Confederacy. In the West, the rivers are a decided advantage for the North, the one area of geography that really did favor the North. The North faced an incredible problem once it got away from the rivers, when it moved into the hinterlands of the Confederacy, because it came up against the fact that there was a very poor network of roads and railroads in the Confederacy, and the logistical demands were almost insurmountable in some cases. The rough yardstick is that a Civil War army, a United States army campaigning during the Civil War, 100,000 men, required at least 600 tons of supplies a day to maintain itself. That's an enormous flow of supplies. Carried in wagons, drawn by draft animals, if you don't have well-developed roads, it is a nightmare to maintain an army of that size in the hinterlands of the Confederacy. It's much easier to supply them using rivers, but the North ran out of rivers in the Western Theater, for example, and had to strike into the hinterlands, and then the obstacles became such that they often frustrated campaigns. And I'll use Ulysses S. Grant's campaign against Vicksburg in 1863 as an example. Grant commanded almost 100,000 men during that operation. But as his supply lines lengthened, as he moved deeper and deeper into the Confederacy, it took more and more men to guard the rear areas. He had to deploy troops all the way along this long line of supply to keep the materials coming to his army. And in the end, he had fewer than a third of his troops at the point of contact with the Confederates, roughly two-thirds of them strung out along these enormous lines of advance. And it showed just how much of an effect the size of the Confederacy and the poor nature of its transportation infrastructure could have on an advancing Union army. The North solved this problem later in the war when they decided simply to live off the countryside when they struck into the Confederacy. Sherman did it in Georgia in 1864. Sheridan did it in the Shenandoah Valley, and other federal commanders did it in other places as well. But we should never forget the importance of the Union troops trying to come to grips with a poor transportation network in an enormous country, a factor made all the worse when bad weather combined with the poor nature of the roads. There are only a handful of roads in the Confederacy as good as the Valley Pike in the Shenandoah Valley, for example, which was an all-weather road, macadamized, that is, crushed stone, graded with bar pits on each side so that it would drain to a degree. It could stand rain and still have heavy use. Most of the roads of the South could not. They became muddy tracks very quickly and almost impassable in poor weather. There's a document in the official records of the War of the Rebellion from a Union officer with a sense of humor. He put in a request through channels. He was taking part in a winter campaign. He said that he would like 50 men 25 feet tall to work in mud 18 feet deep. And that's the nature of southern roads. Ambrose Burnside's frustrating mud march in January of 1863 was an excellent example of bad roads and the weather conspiring to stop a northern offensive. So keep this in mind when you try to judge just how daunting were the obstacles facing the North. Overall, geography favored the Confederacy. Just to summarize this part of the lecture, the size of the South, the coastline, and the nature of the transportation infrastructure, only the rivers might be reckoned at least a partial Union advantage. So let's leave this part of our reckoning of pluses and minuses on each side. with a firm understanding that both sides enjoyed the advantage in some categories. It's not just the case of the overwhelmingly more powerful North getting ready to work its will on the Confederacy. Each side had some advantages. Next time, in our follow-up lecture, we'll look at categories of strength and weakness where neither side really had an advantage and where it was essentially a standoff.